Hello.
Hey, Herbie, it's Dan Mandis calling from Nashville, Tennessee. How are you?
Good, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing good. Can't tell you how much I appreciate you doing this for us.
My pleasure.
So you're officially retired, right?
Oh, yeah. I retired from music 25 years ago.
Oh, did you really? All right. Well, I know you're still playing some music, right?
No. I stopped doing that in 03.
Oh, wow.
And I continued with my production company, Nocturne, you know, the big screen video company.
Oh, yeah.
Invented that, and I sold that in 2011, although it continues to go strong. It's called Solotech now. I left the music business and in the management sense in 93.
The thing that I loved about what you did with Journey was you really treated it like a business more than a lot of other bands. And so, I mean, I could talk to you for hours, but I know that you don't have a lot of time. So let's get to this. So I keep seeing that Neil Sean is on Twitter saying that Journey is done, at least in its current form, which is Arnel Panetta, Jonathan Cain, Ross, Steve Smith, and of course himself, Neil Sean. Do you have any idea what's going on with the Journey right now?
Well, I hadn't heard that he had gone so far as to say it's done. But yeah, there's a lot of palace intrigue and things that have occurred over time and how people and their personalities evolve. You know, and I haven't spoken to Steve Perry in, God knows, I mean, more than 25 years. So the last time I spoke to him briefly and very unpleasant was at Bill Graham's wake in Golden Gate Park. And before that, it was a full 5 years. That was 91 and 86 at the end of the Raison Radio Tour. He was a very, very difficult personality for everyone in the band, and probably especially me. I think he's evolved and is in a different place now in his head. And that took many, many years to occur. And look how inactive he was ever since. You know, really, yeah. I don't know what that was. I always have, I don't know, kind of take, I'm going to take my marbles and go home. Almost in a sense of revenge. And I always say, if you want revenge, dig two graves, and the one you're likely to fill first is your own. And that's kind of what happened with Steve in his career, because here's a guy that was the foremost contemporary vocal stylist on earth, and you don't just throw that away. And there was just no talking him out of it. Maybe he really, really feels that there were physical or mental impediments to him going forward, or I don't know, but I've discussed this with a lot of artists that have gone, had incredibly long careers, and asked them if any of those things would have slowed them down, whether it's drugs, alcohol, or whatever, and they declined. They thought, no, whatever's going on there is happening between the ears, and so I don't know.
What was it?
I have no way of knowing what's going on in his head, and I know that Neil Sean has evolved in very much the same way, and he kind of filled Steve Perry's role. As Steve Perry left, Neil Sean, the victim, more and more became the perpetrator. And I think there's just issues. Neil was always kind of difficult. He always just wanted to rock out, you know, and shred at all times,
sure.
Whether it was appropriate, tasteful, or whatever. You know, you're just making me think of these things that I haven't thought of them in decades. But what a wrestling match that was for not just for me, but for all of us. And without me being there for all these years as a check and balance on that, on an artistic level, I think that their managers are very, very good that have taken over the custodial role of handling this business, which is really a business to exploit the things that were done while I was there, all the way through the greatest hits and box set. It's not like what they're doing today is exploiting new contemporary releases or hits or anything like that. It's basically playing the greatest hits, and which is, you know, a fantastic business to have, you know, and there's many, many artists that do that very same thing, whether it's the Eagles or Fleetwood Mac or any of the other artists that they play with. You know, they have that catalog, and that is indelible and forever. And
well,
they can
yeah.
continue to exploit that.
You know, they don't have a lot of, obviously, current hits. I'm not hurting anybody's feelings by saying that. But I guess my question would be, though, as it relates to the current Journey lineup, I know that Neil has even said over the last couple of days on Twitter, really intimating that maybe the next incarnation of Journey will be Steve Perry and Greg Rolie replacing Arnel Panetta and Jonathan Cain. Do you see a possibility where Steve Perry could come back in Journey with Neil Schon. Do you see a point in time where Steve could return to Journey with Neil Schon?
Oh, I mean, you know, anything is possible. I mean, Donald Trump's our president. What the hell? You know? I mean, I would think it's kind of unlikely. Things must be, in Neil's mind, things must be very, very bad in the current Journey to want to reunite and relive that situation with Steve Perry. Although, you know, when I left the band, that was an inflection point where they really wanted to, at that time, and what was that, 93, 94, they wanted to, put the band back together and tour again, and which, of course, they would have to, at that point, offer that to Steve Perry. And my thought at that time, honest to God, was if Steve Perry were to accept, I would have to decline. And, of course, they worked out something, and he made an album with them that I actually never even listened to. But I indicated at that time that I would bet my lifetime net worth that he would never, ever set foot on stage with them again. And I was right. And so if this were to occur, a reformation with Greg and Steve and Neil and such, that would definitely mean I was dead wrong about that.
You may have to come out of retirement.
What's that?
You may have to come out of retirement because you bet your fortune.
Oh, no. I'm not coming out of retirement for Jesus Christ and his disciples. Been there, done that, and I enjoy myself. Well, I get the benefit of having Herbie Hubbard manage me.
There you go. What, Herbie, was it that made that genius of Neil Schon and Steve Perry and Jonathan Cain, what was it that made that such a brilliant songwriting and rock and roll tandem, if you will, but at the same time, Steve had his demons? I mean, if you think about it, you plucked Steve Perry literally off of his his stepfather's or his uncle, whatever it was, his uncle's chicken coop farm or whatever it was.
No, it wasn't related to him. He worked at a turkey farm,
yeah.
And worked for his stepfather on the weekends building homes. And he was 29 years old, and he had bailed out of the music business because he had made a number of great demos with other great musicians, with good producers, and had failed to attract management or a label at any time. And when I heard the last demo that he had on a group called the Alien Project that he had made, and he had come in and out of my life quite a bit. We had spoken, and he'd handed me tapes, and it's just a real long oddity of a story of how Steve Perry and my life kind of intertwined until I finally heard the final demo tape that had failed for him. And I loved it. I couldn't believe that it had failed and thought, wow, the only reason this failed was the answer that's always there, no management. And of course, this he was trying to get management with that tape as well as a label deal, and it didn't work out. And so there was a phone number on it. I talked to his mother. Then I got her to give me his number at the turkey farm where he worked, and I called him there. And he was very, very reluctant and very resistive to even going, returning to the music business and trying to do this. But I finally talked him into coming up and staying with me in my house, sleeping on the couch, and I wanted to manage that band. But then that very weekend after I called was a 4th of July weekend in 77, and the bass player was killed in an automobile accident, and Perry was devastated. And there was almost no talking him down at that point, but I finally did get him to come to my house and see, you know, to talk about what we could do moving forward. At that time, Journey had evolved, and there was a lead singer in the band, Robert Fleischman, and he was good, but not right. I was coming around to that realization at the same time. All of this was evolving, kind of as I was getting to know Steve Perry and getting into his music and what he was about. And so after a while, I decided, no, it's time for me to terminate Robert Fleischman and try to bring Perry into the band. But the resistance was monumental.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely, under no circumstances are we, you know, is that going to happen? And so I was really dishonest. I am so much a freaking choir boy, it hurts. And so looking back, it is with great regret that I tell you that I lied to the band. And I had Steve Perry traveling with me on tour with Journey. They were opening up to Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. And I was telling them that Steve Perry was John Villanueva, my best friend, And he worked for Journey, and we were together from the beginning of Santana. And I said, "This is Steve Perry, John Villanueva's Portuguese cousin." And for a couple weeks on the road, that's what they believed. Then I, as I knew where I was going, and I was going to have to execute this termination of Robert and this introduction of Steve Perry, and it was rough. And just to be sure, I made sure that Robert Fleischman couldn't make a sound check at the Long Beach Arena. And I mixed the band in those days, and so I was mixing. I had the whole mix set up. And then I went up and said, "Hey, I need to get a line level. Why don't you do this song for you, a song that Robert Fleischman wrote?" And I had, I said, "He's going to sing it, and I just want to get a vocal level." And Steve Perry sang in that sound check. And it's the makings of a movie. I mean, every usher, novelty salesman, stagehands, truck loaders, crews, everybody came to surrounded the stage. This never happens in a soundtrack. And when the song was over, they all applauded. It was like, wow. And I just quickly ran up, grabbed the mic, and Steve Perry walked off the stage and really left the band up there on the stage with their mouths hanging open and just never an explanation. Until finally, when I terminated Robert, that was at the Spelman Arena in Fresno, and I said, "Robert is no longer among us." And then they realized, well, what if that guy, if John Villanueva's cousin, if you're talking about putting him in the band, no way. We love Robert. And I said, "Well, Robert is gone, and so I'm not going to continue this discussion right now." And so I walked out of their dressing room. And then a couple days later, in San Bernardino, I brought them backstage into the where all the equipment and the cases were. And I said, "Guys, I want you to just give me a few minutes," right after our sound check. And I had Steve Perry sit on a row case. And I said, "Steve, play these songs. Play that song, Lights, that I like." And he sang "When the Lights Go Down in the City." And then another one, "Stay a While," that was on the Departure album.
Sure.
And I said, and that was really all the time we had. And I said, "Here's the way it's going to be. We're going to McNichols Arena for tomorrow night. We're going to fly into Denver. We're going to go to the hotel. Steve Perry's going to go up into your room, Neil, and you guys are going to write a song. And I'm going to wait in the lobby until you come down and tell me you've written the song. And I want to hear it. I want to see if you guys have chemistry. And this will be really the quick down and dirty acid test to see what I got." And it's kind of no pressure. But the thing is, they went upstairs and they came down, and the song that they wrote was Patiently on the Infinity album. And I just thought it was freaking brilliant. But there was still a lot of resistance. But it was some months later that Neil called me and said, "Hey, man, this guy's the best singer in rock and roll." I went, "That's right, Neil."
Well, you know what's interesting, and Herbie, what's interesting about that story is that, I mean, I always thought that the bands had the final word. But in your case, you had the final word as the manager. How?
Because I put the band together man by man in the first place.
Yeah, okay. All right. So, in other words, you pulled rank.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't think it was like that in such a sense. That was kind of my job and my space. I think that there was an understanding of that at least then. History gets rewritten by the survivors and the victors and such. But I think at that time, if you say, "Hey, Greg," if you said, "Greg Rowley, whose band is this?" You say, "It's Herbie Herbert's band," and I think that would have been his honest response. And that's not ego or anything else. It's just the just the way it was, and I had that vision, and I knew how to get these guys where we needed to go.
Did you have Herbie, did you have a sound in mind when Steve joined the band? I know that they had the first three albums, what was it, Journey, Look Into the Future, and Next. Did you have a certain sound in your mind when you first heard Steve Perry's demo tape, "If You Need Me, Call Me," and some of those other songs? And then did you just hear it in your mind?
Well, you know those songs.
Oh, you have no idea, my Journey fandom.
I'll tell you what, that's off the charts. Right there, I would have to say, I have never encountered a Journey fan that would know that minutia. That is incredible. That is, "If You Need Me, Call Me," my God. I thought that was a hit song. That's why I wanted to manage that band, and that's Steve Perry.
That is one of the greatest, I mean, for me, because I'm a big Steve Perry fan, that's one of the best vocals that I've come to appreciate over the years, is that song from before Journey. And so when you heard that demo, and then knowing that you, what you did about Neil's guitar, to me, those are two sounds that are so perfectly blended to make the perfect rock and roll song, right? So did you hear the marriage between those two instruments instantly?
Absolutely. I thought, holy shit, Stevie Wonder could see this from outer space. You know, literally. I mean, you know, if I didn't hear that, I'd have to shoot myself. I'd be tone deaf.
Yeah.
How could I exist in the music business and not hear that? It was like a blend. You know, if you had a chance to put Hendrix with Sam Cooke, would you do it? You know?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And so, yeah, I thought, wow, what? You know, the idea is depth of pedigree. I just wanted to assemble musicians of unquestionable skill and artistic merit. You know, all of this can be very, very subjective. I wanted it to be objective. Then no
Yeah.
If you can find a better drummer than Steve Smith, go for it. At the time, actually, when the band was first put together, it was with Prairie Prince.
Sure.
And wow, the trouble we had replacing Prairie Prince. He was so perfect. And Ainsley Dunbar, when we made our first album, Roy Halley, our famous, you know, 20 Grammy-winning producer, Daly would take Ainsley into a room and give him a beatdown and make him play like Prairie,
yeah.
Which was very, very hard. When I had to remove, when the band insisted that I remove Ainsley after the Infinity album and replace him with Steve Smith, and they found Steve Smith because he was playing with Montrose, who was the opening band on the Journey 78 tour, which was Journey, Montrose, and Van Halen. And that was a three-act package and went through every theater in America. Montrose had changed from the Sammy Hagar, Bill Church band to, you know, an instrumental band, but they had this drummer. And he played a solo every night that was exceptional. And he was just really an exceptional drummer. And so when they wanted Ainsley gone, and they saw Smith, let's lose Ainsley, and you go get that guy. When I went to get that guy, I had to be sure that he could satisfy Steve Perry with a backbeat. Ainsley was a very white, from Liverpool, English drummer that didn't really understand soul and a backbeat.
Right.
And so we took Smith and did this project for King Biscuit Flower Hour called a Super Jam. And I got the Tower of Power horns and the two black chicks from Stone Ground, Annie Sampson and Joe Baker and Tommy Johnson from the Doobie Brothers. And we did old soul song and did a radio special. It was fabulous. And that proved to me that Smith was the goods. And it proved it to Perry and everyone else. And I think he's been the number one overall drummer in the world for 30 years running in Modern Drummer magazine, something like that.
Well, he's got such just very briefly, he's got such a wide range of skills. I mean, he's a great jazz drummer with vital information. He can do the rock and roll. But when you listen to Infinity and then you listen to Evolution, it's a decidedly, I mean, at least to me, and I'm not a musician, but it's a decidedly different sound because when you listen to, say, Loving You Is Easy or Just the Same Way, it's such a far cry from, you know, at least to me, Wheel in the Sky. It's got a more of a groove on Evolution. Was that something?
Oh, more of a groove. And since you're really citing some of those Evolution songs, one that really was special for me was Sweet and Simple. And that open feel that Smith can play better than anyone. I remember being on stage one day with Brian Adams, who was our opening act in 83, and he might have been playing Open Arms or one of those songs where that open, big ballad feel, no one can execute that better than Steve Smith. Brian Adams grabbed me by the arm. Oh, my God, how am I ever going to have that? And I go, well, just call me when you need it. He did, and Steve played on the Heaven single for him, and there it is.
Steve Smith played on Heaven?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
And so you go listen to that track, and that tells you all you want to know about Steve Smith. If there's a better ballad drummer, you're going to have to argue with me about it. And then it's a double discipline. Smith is so skilled that the most up-tempo songs like Line of Fire and, you know, things that we used to do are require incredible discipline to maintain perfect meter at a very, very up-tempo like that. In the same way, it requires incredible discipline, nail the groove on a big, open ballad tempo like Open Arms. Perfect in both disciplines. And, you know, when they did go in 86, and insist that I terminate Smith and Valerie.
Yes.
Replace them with Mike Baird and Randy Jackson. A total freaking joke. Not that they're not good musicians. They were. But they weren't Journey. And they really weren't what was supposed to happen. But on that, we auditioned just about every great drummer in America, from Chad Wackerman to Omar Hakim. And none of them could play Don't Stop Believin', that drum part.
Herbie, I guess the question is, I never really understood, because of the fact that Steve Smith was such a good drummer. I'm not a musician, so I don't know if Ross Valerie is a good bass player. So,
very good. He is very, very solid. And you need somebody to hold down the fort. You know, he's really perfect. I had a Pete Sears. I had Gerald Johnson, who was playing for another artist I managed, Steve Miller at the time, and they wanted to be in the early formation of Journey. And Pete Sears is just a brilliant talent. He played with Starship and many other things. But Ross, I just decided he is the perfect guy.
Yeah.
Of course, I exalted my friend from childhood.
Oh, I didn't know that you and Ross were friends from childhood. Wow, that's amazing. So that had to be really painful when you had to pull him aside and say, you know, got to cut you loose.
Yeah, but you know what? I took care of those Smith and Valerie and honored them and paid them as if they were there.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Although, obviously, in music.
That was me. The band was not in favor of that, but they went along with it because I just probably threw a complete tantrum.
So Greg Rolie decides to leave after the Departure album and before Escape and, you know, before Captured is finished. Was there a power struggle going on within the band as far as, you know, Rolie doing the vocals versus Perry doing the vocals versus, you know, a difference in what was going on?
There was not, but there was something, a power, a negative force that Perry was creating. He was divisive, maybe jealous. You know, he really was jealous of the relationship that I had with Greg and that I had with Neil. But we had gone through, Greg and I especially, through the Santana experience from day one. You know, through the first four albums on Santana, and when we were really young, we did that. And you get tight, like, you can't get tight that way. You know, I don't know, when you're a part of a team like that and
sure.
You just have this long-term love affair, it doesn't mean we love Perry any less or wanted to treat him any differently, but no, you can't have the same depth of relationship that I have with Neil Sean because you're brand new to me, and I want to love you just as much and treat you equally. But hey, you know, no, there's a special thing going on with me and Neil, almost father and son with me and Neil,
right.
And very, very tight and super respectful between me and Greg Rolie. I would say Greg, without question, is the best overall client or musician that I ever managed. I just love the guy. He took me to lunch, and I think it was in Frankfurt in 1980, on the before the tour was over, and announced that he was going to leave at the end of the tour, and I professed total devastation.
Yeah.
He was my rock, and I knew that I was in for nothing but trouble after that. And it was Greg. I said, what the f*** am I going to do? Who in the f*** can fill your shoes? And he said, Herbie, that act you put on this whole tour this year, Babies? I go, yeah? He goes, that keyboard player. I go, you're shitting me. Really? I can't. And I, of course, I'd watched the Babies time and time again, but Jonathan had never registered on me. And he said, you and I are going to go watch this guy together. And we're playing the L.A. Coliseum, 85,000 people. We'll sit and we'll watch the Babies at the L.A. Coliseum, and you show me this guy. And he did. And I said, okay, you're right. This guy has got a lot more depth than I realized. And then when I determined subsequently what a tremendous songwriter he was, oh, my God. And I mean, and John Cain is probably the most complete songwriter. I think on songs like Faithfully and Open Arms, two tremendous songs right there, maybe even Cinder My Love, I'm not looking at song credits, but I would say no matter what the credits say, these were John Cain songs that he brought in and so near to complete and total that, you know, there it is.
Well, yeah, and those songs that you just mentioned, they were all indeed written by Jonathan Cain. One of the things that you said, I want to go back to this a couple of minutes. You talked about how you felt like Perry may have felt like he was jealous of your relationship with Greg and with Neil because of your history with those guys going back to Santana. At the end of that Behind the Music special, Perry said he always felt like the outside guy. Nobody understood that, but I wonder with what you just said about maybe he was jealous, maybe that's what he meant.
And so, you know, Perry was in control of the editing of that VH1 special. Shot video and interviewed me for 12 hours. And a couple minutes made it because I made sure that I said the truth so much that I suggested at the end of the interview that not one bit of what I said to you guys today on camera will be allowed in this piece.
Mm.
And I was almost right. And so when he said, I never felt part of it, you know what I said on camera? I said, that's like the Pope saying he didn't feel Catholic.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's just so patently absurd and ridiculous. And, you know, but hey, it's perception over fact. If that's the way the guy wanted to think and feel at the time, there's no talking him out of it, you know?
Yeah.
It's just what do? You got to live with it. And that's the way it was. We just had to live with whatever Perry's perceptions were, right, wrong, or indifferent.
Yeah, and he sounds like a guy who obviously he has demons. He's somebody who is very complicated personality, I think, to say the least. And so I guess when it came time for Jonathan Cain to come into the band, just pick it up from there, we've got Infinity, then we've got Evolution and Departure. Each one of those albums has a very distinct sound to them. Then Jonathan Cain comes in, and the sound of the band, at least to me, changes incredibly. It's got more of an uplifting spirit, I think. There's just a difference there, and it's obviously in the songwriting and perhaps the playing.
You're completely correct about the songwriting. Big change, and that was John Cain. And then there's a big change in the sound, because when you move from a B3 organ, a Hammond organ, to a grand piano, that's a monumental change right there. And so much that organ was so much the basis of Santana and Journey, with Greg, with such a much bigger voice than you might realize with that organ. And so, and then in comes John Cain, and it's all of a sudden these are piano-based compositions. And another big, big change at that point was the vocals. Greg was much, much stronger vocalist than John Cain. So John had to work on that a lot, and did, and got better and better and better. But he was never going to have the voice as identifiable and the signature as Greg's, who had been making hits like Black Magic Woman for, you know, eons, right? And was just a strong choral, you know, group vocalist. At the end of 80, we did a video at the Sun Plaza in Tokyo. And one day I sat down and watched that video and couldn't believe what a great vocal group Journey had come. And that was probably their vocal peak with Greg at the end of 80. They were just phenomenal. No question about it.
Yeah.
And then the vocals suffered when John came in, but everything else improved. I remember when we did the first, when the Escape album was finished, and we had a showcase at Fantasy Studios and brought all the major label people and all the correct luminaries to hear this, the first playing of that album, that there were things that occurred there that night, and things that Perry said regarding the songwriting and failing to credit John Cain for what an incredible contribution he had made and how much he had impacted or changed the band or our ability to make such a landmark record. It hadn't sold, you know, 10 million plus yet. This was before it was even released, but I knew what we had, and I think a lot of people knew what we had. And the things that Perry said that day, the next thing I knew, I'm out in the parking lot with John Cain, and he's crying like a baby. And he's been so insulted, demeaned, diminished, and it was part of the deal. And so there was a lot of conflict between the three of them as songwriters, and this lives on to this very day, and how they divide up their songwriting interests and their publishing interests. Of course, we had Weed High Nightmare Music, and we were all equal partners in the publishing. But the way the songwriting side of that mechanical royalty was split up was contentious, always, without fail. And those arguments, I don't believe, ever fully get settled to this very moment. I think they're still disputing contributions and what should be given for lyrics, for music, and for melody. I bet you a million other bands and artists of significant stature might read this or hear this and say, yeah.
Yeah.
Get in line. You know, this is universal. This happens to everyone. And it's just a real tough deal.
Did you see problems with the solo albums? I mean, it's now, you're going to have to help me out. I think it's about 1986 or so. Neil has done a couple of solo albums. He did the thing with Jan Hammer. I'm not sure how to say his name.
Yes, I very definitely told them, please, please don't ask me to do this.
Yeah.
Please don't do this. You don't need these alternative outlets for your creativity. You know, it's going to be a problem because Steve Smith, I'll go and make a deal for you that might be a legendary jazz deal for Vital Information. It would be completely out of line because I can negotiate like that.
Yeah.
And it was the most out of line deal a jazz artist ever got. I think I got him 3 albums guaranteed and stupid budgets for jazz. I mean,
yeah.
You know, and the same thing with Jan Hammer and Neil Sean and for a couple albums. And I said, but, you know, don't you doofuses realize that one of these days Steve Perry's going to say it's my turn? And when he does that, and he goes out and gets the best studio musicians around, what's going to be the difference? And then if he really likes that and it's successful, and if I don't make it succeed, it'll probably be the end of Journey, and or at least the end of my relationship with Steve. And so I'm in an impossible position. And when I do that, there's just going to be hell to pay. And they couldn't see it, couldn't get that. And that's pretty much exactly what happened. And so I did those projects for Neil and for Smith. And then when it came to the 84 record Street Talk by Steve Perry, well, I had to go out there. And Steve Perry, by that time, made it on no uncertain terms. There would be no future Journey unless I really made his solo project happen.
Wow.
In a very, very major way. The problem with that is, his perception of Make It Happen was, this record's brilliant. I decreed it such, and it was very good.
Yeah.
But I wanted to sell more than Journey just sold on Escape, and they just sold 10 million.
Sure. Yeah, that's a little hard.
And,
yeah.
The most successful solo artist at this point in time, ever in the history of the music business, coming out of a major group, is Stevie Nicks' Belladonna. She sold 3 million, barely.
Yeah.
But this is a time period where the members of Pink Floyd, none of them even went gold with their initial releases. At that time, Phil Collins didn't even get gold with his first FaceTime or whatever it was called, whether it was Members of the Cars or Hall & Oates. I mean, these solo records were just constantly failed attempts. Even Don Henley out of the Eagles with his first solo record didn't go gold. That was with Dirty Laundry on it. He eventually went gold when the Dirty Laundry song made it to the Vision Quest soundtrack,
right,
which was a multi-million seller, and that drug is record up. But this is a very difficult thing. And I was that successful with Oh Sherry and a number of singles, working it hard. I mean, I put every ounce I had into that thing and got it double platinum, heading to triple platinum. And C. Perry's reaction to that was, I him over. And he couldn't tell enough people how much I sandbagged him and screwed him over. And I've always felt that he was trying to get even ever since.
Interesting. But why did he feel that way? I guess that would be my question. I mean, he went double platinum.
Because double platinum wasn't 10 million.
No.
You know, it's nothing to do with reality. I mean, it's just his perception and fucking truth and reality be damned. I mean, you got to deal with these people's perceptions.
Herbie, let me ask you, over the years, you saw Steve Perry emerge as somebody who I've heard described as somebody who was very shy, maybe not such a confident vocalist, felt like an outsider in the band, to the person that you're describing now, which somebody who was very much took control of the band. Did you notice at the time that his personality perhaps was evolving?
Hard to say. I mean, I think that, you know, I have said to the other members of the band, this is going to sound weird, but I said to them, you got to realize that we do not know really anything about Steve Perry. And I would look them in the eye and say, none of you can tell me anything about that guy, not even his sexual preference. And so what the heck? And I'll tell you what. There's nothing about you that he doesn't know. He's an authority on all of us, at least in his own mind, and yet we know very little about him or what motivates him or how he's thinking, because it's such an anathema to our thinking and how we are and how we've grown to be over the years as a team. And he came in and wanted to be that kind of isolated outsider, and that was kind of his choice. It was certainly not our choice.
It must have been heartbreaking when the band ultimately then broke up. And did Steve ever really take responsibility for his role in the breakup of Journey both times?
No, he never actually articulated it, acknowledged it, basically every audience on the 86 tour, he said, we'll be back soon
yeah.
on the Raison Radio Tour. And what he would do is he would just not respond. And so what he did, I'll tell you what, not so much for me or the other musicians, we make a lot of money, but for the crew and for everybody else in the staff, for the production company, sound, lights, trucking, busing, whatever. And so much of that we did for ourselves with the production company that I formed with the members of Journey Nocturne. We were all partners initially, but after that 83 tour, Steve Perry wanted to dismantle everything, our real estate partnerships. He wanted to break down the company, lose all the employees.
Yeah.
Get rid of the real estate and not have this administrative state that he felt that he was obligated to support. And me being, you know, real estate is actually my forte, not music. And so, you know, the chips they left on the table, they made major profits selling the properties and the investments that I'd made for them
yeah.
at that time. They left $100 million on the table. And that's no... You know, it's just really too bad. It's really sad. And he wanted to tear that down. And then so in 84, we expected the tour. He just didn't do it, never said he wouldn't. And then in 85, same thing. And then in 80, and then when they started making that Raison Radio record, they recorded that record with Steve Smith and with Valerie, I believe. And then he said, no, we want to re-record it now with other bass players. You got to fire those two guys. He and Neil and Jonathan, the three of them, took me on a walk in Sausalito on the waterfront and informed me that was my new job, to terminate Smith and Valerie and to replace them and to organize auditions for bass players and drummers, countless and numbers. I mean, you know, felt like 50 drummers, probably too many. I'm probably exaggerating, but...
Yeah, but you're in the middle of recording an album, and you guys need to get out on tour, and now you're having to deal
right.
with this. Were you surprised, Herbie, at the nice things that Steve Perry said at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction? He said great things about you. He said great things about all the other band members. And I know that you've been a critical of Perry in other interviews. I was surprised by that.
Well, I was, more jaw-dropped and shocked than anything. And I'm there up close at their table, and I see Jonathan grab Neil Sean by the arm right there on stage. And he said something to the effect of, do you believe the words coming out of his mouth? Right there on stage. I mean, not only was I shocked, I know many in the audience were shocked, but the band was f***ing shocked, you know?
Yeah.
And especially he was saying nice things about me after f***ing 30 years of, I'm going to get even if it's the last thing I do. This guy made me $40 million and I want to kill him, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And so, yeah, definitely shocking, to which I say a number of thoughts. Number one, oh, good, fantastic, better late than never. But also at the same time, meaningless to me. I left the music business 25 years ago. Really doesn't matter to me what Steve Perry thinks one way or another, you know, and it hasn't ever. And so, and that hasn't really changed just because he said something nice. And I thought at the time, really actually sitting there, that was for him, not for me. And I almost consider him to be somewhat of a sociopath and just... that was really, to have empathy or compassion, a gratitude, appreciation, are not things that come easy to him. And so I thought that this was a good thing for Steve, really good for him. That, you know, he's got to do those things to demonstrate to himself that he is he could be better than that.
Do you think that he was sincere? Do you think he is trying himself to maybe some self-improvement kind of a thing, or do you think that was all for show?
Well, you know, unfortunately, and somewhat cynically, it could be both. I want to believe that it was sincere. He mentioned, because they edited the hell out of it. If you see a YouTube of the original thank yous everybody spoke, they on the HBO thing, they took out Ainsley and Ross and Smith completely, and they edited down Steve Perry and the others. And Steve Perry had mentioned Jim McCandless and Benny Collins and former employees of ours that had passed on, Jack Villanueva, and very close and near and dear in the family. And these are the kinds of things that just would not be uttered by a Steve Perry in a bygone time. And so we were just, I think we were all very, very much shocked. It was great to hear. Fantastic. I mean, just... It was wonderful, and I think, everybody that saw it felt that it was heartfelt, and so if he was faking it, And if it was just for show, well, it just goes to show you what a good showman he is, you know, and sincerity works.
But, yeah, and Herbie, let me ask you a question. One of the problems apparently with Neil, modern day now, so just in the last week,
right.
One of the problems that Neil has right now is the fact that he and Ross are on the way out because, or on the outs, because Ross voted not to have Greg Rolie up on stage at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, either the performance or the induction. I know he was up there in the performance or in the induction ceremony, but not the performance, I think. Was there some sort of a problem between Ross and Greg? Because that seems weird to me.
No, I don't think so. I think that all sounds a little scrambled to me.
Yeah, it sounds scrambled to me too, but
Greg,
he said on Twitter, Ross is no help.
I thought Greg did perform with the band on when they did Light, and he was up there on the stage. No, Greg was very much a part of that. And I can't imagine Greg and Ross having any kind of a problem at all.
It's odd. And something that I've been trying to figure out, too, which is why I actually wrote down that question, because it didn't make any sense to me. Are you able at this point, Herbie, I know that you are somebody who did music for many, many years, and you're such a vital part, clearly, of Journey. Are you able to just sit down and listen to Journey and listen to a song like Still They Ride and just marvel at the vocals and the guitar and the songwriting? Are you still able to just take a step back from all the personalities and appreciate the music?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I sequenced every one of those records. And I would sit, they'd hand me that deliver a finished record to me, and I would sit somewhere. I rented a system and put it in a hotel room in Ventura where we were doing 3 sold-out shows with Journey back in when they delivered the Escape album. And I remember listening and writing my list down. And I said, okay, the lead-off song is going to be Don't Stop Believe. And you know, just going through songs like Still They Ride, you know, and just saying, this is how I'm going to put that record together. And there was a reason and a message of the madness on all of that. And it makes me think of putting Open Arms, the biggest hit of their career, was the very last song at the very end of the Escape album.
Yep.
Because there was so much resistance in the studio when it was recorded. And I went in one day, and Jonathan and Neil were teasing Steve Perry relentlessly. He was singing Open Arms in there, and I couldn't believe it. I took him into the side room. I go, guys, this is you guys are telling him he sounds like Wayne Newton and all this other and he's out there singing his heart out on a great song that he obviously wrote a great song. This is a smash. Neil, I didn't want it on the record. I go, man, that's a smash. Are you kidding me? I mean, he wrote a great song. And then Jonathan said, no, he didn't write it. I wrote it. I went, well, that makes it even more stupid that you guys are heckling him and f***ing around here. You know, it's crazy. Neil would have preferred the record not be on the album. That's not be on the album. And look, you know, look what a monumental song. It's the number one power ballad of all time.
Here's what I don't get, though. Patiently, stay a while. I'm sure if I thought of, Sweet and Simple and some of these other songs, they were also, I guess, I don't know if I would call them power ballads, but they were certainly kind of sort of in the same vein as Open Arms. Why was Open Arms, what is the difference between, say, a tempo of Open Arms versus the tempo of, say, a Lights or a Stay a While? And, of course, Stay a While is more of a love song than Lights is, but I think you get my point.
And an interesting thing you make me think of right there is, you know, in terms of songwriting, I would say Sweet and Simple and definitely Stay a While is almost 100% Steve Perry. So that puts him right there in many ways on a par with Jonathan Cain. It doesn't mean that they necessarily had great chemistry when they were trying to write songs together, and there was animosities there. But at any rate, no, I think that a song like Sweet and Simple or Could Have Been a massive hit. It's the music business is so much about the timing and the sequence and when and how and getting other people to believe and buy into it. I was always a big believer in Sweet and Simple. I never got another single person to agree with me.
You know, one of the great things about Journey is there are so many songs that from those first 3 albums that are just incredible, like Loving You Is Easy, Precious
Yep.
Time, and People and Places from the Departure album that never went anywhere. Probably they didn't get played beyond the particular tour, like Departure Tour for People and Places and so forth. But they live on because they are so such incredible songs.
Let me tell you, you make me think again. The other act that was on that L.A. Coliseum show was Black Sabbath.
Mm.
And Sandy Pearlman, the late Sandy Pearlman, who just passed away recently, was their manager. He also managed Blue Oyster Cult, and I knew him forever. And Sandy grabbed me by the arm. I was standing on stage. Journey was performing. And I think the fourth song in the set that day was Too Late, the opening song on Evolution.
Yep.
And I would tell you without a doubt that the biggest audience response that Journey ever got was that performance that day of Too Late. An obscure song. I don't believe we ever released it as a single or anything, but it was so great. Such a great song, delivered and performed so perfectly. And the crowd went completely, utterly ballistic. And everything that 85,000 people could grab went up in the air. And Sandy grabbed me by the arm and he said, every manager who has ever lived dreams of having a moment like this. This is your moment. And how odd to have somebody say that to me, to have it be true and have it be that song.
Yeah.
And boy, has that ever stuck with me.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I've only got two questions left because our time is now very limited. One,
okay.
You've got, it's way back when, right? It's the 1970s, early 1970s, late 60s, whatever. 15 years old, Neil Schon, you and Greg Rolie are, you know, basically picking this kid up from high school and letting him, you know, play guitar and so forth. What did his parents say? Were his parents like, wait, who are these dudes that are picking up our teenage son going playing guitar? Was there any sort of parental pushback?
There was, but his father, Matt, was a musician and an incredibly brilliant musician, composer, and arranger.
Mm.
And his mother was a singer, and so they understood these things. And Jack Villanueva would go and sneak him out the bedroom window and bring him up to the Wally Heider studio where we were recording the Abraxas album with Santana, and or take him to Keystone Corner where he would jam with Elvin Bishop, or take him to one of the other clubs, and I can't remember, the Troubadour, I think it was called, in San Francisco. No, not the Troubadour, whatever. It was a club where Gabor Szabo was playing, and he took Neil there, and Gabor was very influential to Neil and to Carlos with Spellbinder and some of that stuff. And Jack took him there, and Neil was going to sit in with Gabor Szabo. When Jack snuck him out that night, Neil's parents were out, and but he didn't realize they went out to go see Gabor Szabo. And so there they are at a jazz show late at night, and all of a sudden their son comes on stage to play with Gabor, and they think he's at home in bed with a babysitter.
Do you keep in touch with any of the guys now? Are you still in touch with Neil? I mean, for the love of Pete, you guys were band of brothers for so many years, and you discovered Steve Perry, obviously. I doubt you're still in touch with him, but are you still in touch with Neil and some of the other guys?
Yeah, I see him occasionally when there's an event like the Hall of Fame. Of course, I saw them all there, but not super regularly. But Ross Valerie, I go to lunch with all the time. I'll probably call him today and we'll hook up. And then, I correspond with Neil. He mostly asks me questions about old business or songwriting splits. That's why I was telling you that's contentious to this very day. But not a whole lot of contact, no. I'm a developer. I build things.
It's amazing, Herbie, interview's over. But what's interesting, you say that something you said is fascinating is you said that real estate is actually your forte, not music. It's like I don't know how successful you must be in real estate, but if you have surpassed your success in music, that's pretty incredible.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this.